Chapter 8, America Secedes from the Empire, 1775 to 1783. Bloodshed at Lexington and Concord in April of 1775 was a clarion call to arms. About 20,000 musket-bearing minutemen swarmed around Boston, there to entrap the outnumbered British. The Second Continental Congress met in Philadelphia the next month, on May 10, 1775, and this time the full slate of 13 colonies was represented. The conservative element in Congress was still strong, despite the shooting in Massachusetts. There was still no well-defined sentiment for independence, merely a desire to continue fighting in the hope that the king and parliament would consent to a redress of grievances. Congress hopefully drafted new appeals to the British people and king, appeals that were spurned. Anticipating a possible rebuff, the delegates also adopted measures to raise money and to create an army and a navy. The British and the Americans now teetered on the brink of all-out warfare. Perhaps the most important single action of the Congress was to select George Washington, one of its members already in an officer's uniform, to head the hastily improvised army besieging Boston. This choice was made with considerable misgivings. The tall, powerfully built, dignified Virginia planter, then 43, had never risen above the rank of a colonel in the militia. His largest command had numbered only 1,200 men, and that had been some 20 years earlier. Falling short of true military genius, Washington would actually lose more pitched battles than he won. But the distinguished Virginian was gifted with outstanding powers of leadership and immense strength of character. He radiated patience, courage, self-discipline, and a sense of justice. He was a great moral force, rather than a great military mind, a symbol and a rallying point. People instinctively trusted him. They sensed that when he put himself at the head of a cause, he was prepared, if necessary, to go down with the ship. He insisted on serving without pay, though he kept a careful expense account amounting to more than $100,000. Later, he sternly reprimanded his steward at Mount Vernon for providing the enemy, under duress, with supplies. He would have preferred to see the enemy put the torch to his mansion. The Continental Congress, though dimly perceiving Washington's qualities of leadership, chose more wisely than it knew. His selection, in truth, was largely political. Americans in other sections of the colonies, already jealous, were beginning to distrust the large New England army being collected around Boston. Prudence suggested a commander from Virginia, the largest and most populous of the colonies. As a man of wealth, both by inheritance and by marriage, Washington could not be accused of being a fortune seeker. As an aristocrat, he could be counted on by his peers to check the excess of the masses. The clash of arms continued on a strangely contradictory basis. On the one hand, the Americans were emphatically affirming their loyalty to the king and earnestly voicing their desire to patch up difficulties. On the other hand, they were raising armies and shooting down His Majesty's soldiers. This curious war of inconsistency was fought for 14 long months, from April 1775 to July 1776, before the fatal plunge into independence was taken. Gradually, the tempo of warfare increased. In May 1775, a tiny American force under Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold surprised and captured the British garrisons at Ticonderoga and Crown Point, on the scenic lakes of Upper New York. A priceless store of gunpowder and artillery for the siege of Boston was thus secured. In June 1775, the colonists seized a hill, now known as Bunker Hill, actually Breed's Hill, from which they menaced the enemy in Boston. The British, instead of cutting off the retreat of their foes by flanking them, blundered bloodily when they launched a frontal attack with 3,000 men. Sharpshooting Americans, numbering 1,500 and strongly entrenched, mowed down the advancing redcoats with frightful slaughter. But the colonists' scanty store of gunpowder finally gave out, and they were forced to abandon the hill in disorder. With two more such victories, remarked the French foreign minister, the British would have no army left in America. Even at this late date, in July 1775, the Continental Congress adopted the Olive Branch Petition, professing American loyalty to the crown and begging the king to prevent further hostilities. But following Bunker Hill, King George III slammed the door on all hope of reconciliation. In August 1775, he formally proclaimed the colonies in rebellion. The skirmishes were now out-and-out treason, a hanging crime. The next month, he widened the chasm when he sealed arrangements for hiring thousands of German troops to help crush his rebellious subjects. Six German princes involved in the transaction needed the money. One reputedly had 74 children. George III needed the men. Because most of these soldiers for hire came from the German principality of Hesse, the Americans called all the European mercenaries Hessians. News of the Hessian deal shocked the colonists. The quarrel, they felt, was within the family. Why bring in outside mercenaries, especially foreigners, who had an exaggerated reputation for butchery? Hessian hirelings proved to be good soldiers in a mechanical sense, but many of them were more interested in booty than in duty. For good reason, they were dubbed Hessian flies. Seduced by American promises of land, hundreds of them finally deserted and remained in America to become respected citizens. The unsheathed sword continued to take its toll. In October 1775, on the eve of a cruel winter, the British burned Falmouth, Portland, Maine. In that same autumn, the rebels daringly undertook a two-pronged invasion of Canada. American leaders believed, erroneously, that the conquered French were explosively restive under the British yoke. A successful assault on Canada would add a 14th colony, while depriving Britain of a valuable base for striking at the colonies in revolt. But this large-scale attack, involving some 2,000 American troops, contradicted the claim of the colonists that they were merely fighting defensively for a redress of grievances. Invasion northward was undisguised offensive warfare. This bold stroke for Canada narrowly missed success. One invading column, under the Irish-born General Richard Montgomery, formerly of the British Army, pushed up the Lake Champlain route and captured Montreal. He was joined at Quebec by the bedraggled army of General Benedict Arnold, whose men had been reduced to eating dogs and shoe leather during their grueling march through the Maine woods. An assault on Quebec, launched on the last day of 1775, was beaten off. The able Montgomery was killed. The dashing Arnold was wounded in one leg. Scattered remnants under his command retreated up the St. Lawrence River, reversing the way Montgomery had come. French-Canadian leaders, who had been generously treated by the British in the Quebec Act of 1774, showed no real desire to welcome the plundering anti-Catholic invaders. Bitter fighting persisted in the colonies, though most Americans continued to disclaim a desire for independence. In January 1776, the British set fire to the Virginia town of Norfolk. In March, the British were finally forced to evacuate Boston, taking with them the leading friends of the king. Evacuation Day is still celebrated annually in Boston. In the South, the rebellious colonists won two victories in 1776, one in February against some 1,500 loyalists at Moore's Creek Bridge in North Carolina, and the other in June against an invading British fleet at Charleston Harbor. Why did Americans continue to deny any intention of independence? Loyalty to the empire was deeply ingrained. Many Americans continued to consider themselves part of a transatlantic community, in which the mother country of Britain played a leading role. Colonial unity was growing, but far from robust. An open rebellion was dangerous, especially against a formidable Britain. Irish rebels of that day were customarily hanged, drawn, and quartered. American rebels might have fared no better. As late as January 1776, 5 months before independence was declared, the king's health was being toasted by the officers of Washington's mess near Boston. "God save the king" had not yet been replaced by "God save the Congress." Gradually, the Americans were shocked into recognizing the necessity of separating from the crown. Their eyes were jolted open by harsh British acts like the burning of Falmouth and Norfolk, and especially by the hiring of the Hessians. Then in 1776 came the publication of Common Sense, one of the most influential pamphlets ever written. Its author was the radical Thomas Paine, once an impoverished corset maker's apprentice who had come over from Britain a year earlier. He began his incendiary tract with a treatise on the nature of government and eloquently anticipated Thomas Jefferson's declaration that the only lawful states were those that derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. As for the king, whom the Americans professed to revere, he was nothing but the royal brute of Great Britain. Common Sense became a whirlwind bestseller. Within a few months, the astonishing total of 120,000 copies were sold. Paine flatly branded the shilly-shallying of the colonists as contrary to common sense. Nowhere in the physical universe did the smaller heavenly body control the larger one. So why should the tiny island of Britain control the vast continent of America? Paine's pen went a long way toward convincing the American colonists that their true cause was independence rather than reconciliation with Britain. Not least because without independence, they could not hope for foreign assistance. Paine could thus be said to have drafted the foundational document not only of American independence, but of American foreign policy as well. Paine's passionate protest was as compelling as it was eloquent and radical, even doubly radical. It called not simply for independence, but for the creation of a new kind of political society, a republic, where power flowed from the people themselves, not from a corrupt and despotic monarch. In language laced with biblical imagery familiar to common folk, he argued that all government officials, governors, senators, and judges, not just representatives in a House of Commons, should derive their authority from popular consent. Paine was hardly the first person to champion a republican form of government. Political philosophers had advanced the idea since the days of classical Greece and Rome. Revived in the Renaissance and in 17th century England, republican ideals had uneasily survived within the British mixed government, with its delicate balance of king, nobility, and commons. Republicanism particularly appealed to British politicians critical of excess of power in the hands of the king and his advisers. Their writings found a responsive audience among the American colonists, who interpreted the vengeful royal acts of the previous decade as part of a monarchical conspiracy to strip them of their liberties as British subjects. Paine's radical prescription for the colonists to reject monarchy and empire and embrace an independent republic fell on receptive ears. The colonists' experience with governance had prepared them well for Paine's summons to create a republic. Many settlers, particularly New Englanders, had practiced a kind of republicanism in their democratic town meetings and annual elections. While the popular elected committees of correspondence during 1774 and 1775 had demonstrated the feasibility of republican government, the absence of a hereditary aristocracy and the relative equality of condition enjoyed by landowning farmers meshed well with the republican repudiation of a fixed hierarchy of power. Most Americans considered citizen virtue fundamental to any successful republican government, because political power no longer rested with the central, all-powerful authority of the king. Individuals in a republic needed to sacrifice their personal self-interest to the public good. The collective good of the people mattered more than the private rights and interests of individuals. Paine inspired his contemporaries to view America as fertile ground for the cultivation of such civic virtue. Yet not all patriots agreed with Paine's ultra-democratic approach to republicanism. Some favored a republic ruled by a natural aristocracy of talent. Republicanism for them meant an end to hereditary aristocracy, but not an end to all social hierarchy. These more conservative republicans feared that the fervor for liberty would overwhelm the stability of the social order. They watched with trepidation as the lower orders of society, poorer farmers, tenants, and laboring classes in towns and cities, seemed to embrace a kind of runaway republicanism that amounted to radical leveling. The contest to define the nature of American republicanism would noisily continue for at least the next 100 years. Members of the Philadelphia Congress, instructed by their respective colonies, gradually edged toward a clean break. On June 7, 1776, fiery Richard Henry Lee of Virginia moved that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. After considerable debate, the motion was adopted nearly a month later, on July 2, 1776. The passing of Lee's resolution was the formal declaration of independence by the American colonies, and technically this was all that was needed to cut the British tie. John Adams wrote confidently that even thereafter, July 2nd would be celebrated annually with fireworks. But something more was required. An epical rapture of this kind called for some formal explanation. An inspirational appeal was also needed to enlist other British colonies in the Americas to invite assistance from foreign nations and to rally resistance at home. Shortly after Lee made his memorable motion on June 7, Congress appointed a committee to prepare a more formal statement of separation. The task of drafting it fell to Thomas Jefferson, a tall, freckled, sandy-haired Virginia lawyer of 33. Despite his youth, he was already recognized as a brilliant writer, and he measured up splendidly to the awesome assignment. After some debate and amendment, the Declaration of Independence was formally approved by the Congress on July 4th, 1776. It might better have been called the Explanation of Independence, or as one contemporary described it, Mr. Jefferson's advertisement of Mr. Lee's resolution. Jefferson's pronouncement, couched in a lofty style, was magnificent. He gave his appeal universality by invoking the natural rights of humankind, not just British rights. He argued persuasively that because the king had flouted these rights, the colonists were justified in cutting their connection. He then set forth a long list of the presumably tyrannous misdeeds of George III. The overdrawn bill of indictment included imposing taxes without consent, dispensing without trial by jury, abolishing valued laws, establishing a military dictatorship, maintaining standing armies in peacetime, cutting off trade, burning towns, hiring mercenaries, and inciting hostility among the Indians. Jefferson's withering blast was admittedly one-sided. He acted, in effect, as a prosecuting attorney, and he took certain liberties with historical truth. He was not writing history. He was making it through what has been called the world's greatest editorial. He owned many slaves, and his affirmation that all men are created equal was to haunt him and his fellow citizens for generations. The formal Declaration of Independence cleared the air as a thunder shower does on a muggy day. As Paine had predicted, and as events were to prove, foreign assistance could now be solicited with greater hope of success. Those patriots who defied the king were now rebels, not loving subjects shooting their way into reconciliation. They must all hang together, Franklin is said to have grimly remarked, or they would all hang separately. Or, in the eloquent language of the Great Declaration, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Jefferson's defiant Declaration of Independence had a universal impact unmatched by any other American document. This shout heard round the world has been a source of inspiration to countless revolutionary movements against arbitrary authority. Lafayette hung a copy on a wall in his home, leaving beside it room for a future French Declaration of the Rights of Man, a declaration that was officially born 13 years later. The War of Independence, strictly speaking, was a war within a war. Colonists loyal to the king, loyalists, fought the American rebels, patriots, while the rebels also fought the British redcoats. Loyalists were derisively called Tories, after the dominant political faction in Britain, whereas patriots were called Whigs, after the opposition factions in Britain. A popular definition of a Tory among the patriots betrayed bitterness. A Tory is a thing whose head is in England, and its body in America, and its neck ought to be stretched. Like many revolutions, the American Revolution was a minority movement. Many colonists were apathetic or neutral, including the Byrds of Virginia, who sat on the fence. The opposing forces contended not only against each other, but also for the allegiance and support of the civilian population. In this struggle for the hearts and minds of the people, the British proved fatally inept, and the patriot militias played a crucial role. The British military proved able to control only those areas where it could maintain a massive military presence. Elsewhere, as soon as the redcoats had marched on, the rebel militiamen appeared and took up the task of political education, sometimes by coercive means. Often lacking bayonets, but always loaded with political zeal, the ragtag militia units served as remarkably effective agents of revolutionary ideas. they convinced many colonists, even those indifferent to independence, that the British Army was an unreliable friend, and that they had better throw in their lot with the Patriot cause. They also mercilessly harassed small British detachments and occupation forces. One British officer ruefully observed that the Americans would be less dangerous if they had a regular army. Loyalists, numbering perhaps 16% of the American people, remained true to their king. Families often split over the issue of independence. Benjamin Franklin supported the Patriot side, whereas his handsome, illegitimate son, William Franklin, the last royal governor of New Jersey, upheld the Loyalist cause. The Loyalists were tragic figures. For generations, the British in the New World had been taught fidelity to the crown. Loyalty is ordinarily regarded as a major virtue, loyalty to one's family, one's friends, one's country. If the king had triumphed, as he seemed likely to do, the Loyalists would have been acclaimed patriots, and defeated rebels like Washington would have been disgraced, severely punished, and probably forgotten. Many people of education and wealth, of culture and caution, remained loyal. These wary souls were satisfied with their lot and believed that any violent change would only be for the worse. Loyalists were also more numerous among the older generation. Young people make revolutions, and from the outset, energetic, purposeful, and militant young people surged forward. Figures like the sleeplessly scheming Samuel Adams and the impassioned Patrick Henry, whose flaming outcry before the Virginia Assembly, "Give me liberty or give me death," still quickens patriotic pulses. Loyalists also included the king's officers and other beneficiaries of the crown, people who knew from which side their daily bread came. The same was generally true of the Anglican clergy and a large portion of their congregations, all of whom had long been taught submission to the king. Usually, the Loyalists were most numerous where the Anglican church was strongest. A notable exception was Virginia, where the debt-burdened Anglican aristocrats flocked into the rebel camp. The king's followers were well entrenched in aristocratic New York City and Charleston, and also in Quaker Pennsylvania and New Jersey, where General Washington felt that he was fighting in the enemy's country. While his men were starving at Valley Forge, nearby Pennsylvania farmers were selling their produce to the British for the king's gold. Loyalists were least numerous in New England, where self-government was especially strong and mercantilism was especially weak. Rebels were the most numerous where Presbyterianism and Congregationalism flourished, notably in New England. Invading British armies vented their contempt and anger by using Yankee churches for pigsties. Before the Declaration of Independence in 1776, persecution of the Loyalists was relatively mild, yet they were subjected to some brutality, including tarring and feathering and riding astride fence rails. After the Declaration of Independence, which sharply separated Loyalists from Patriots, harsher methods prevailed. The rebels naturally desired a united front. Putting loyalty to the colonies first, they regarded their opponents, not themselves, as traitors. Loyalists were roughly handled. Hundreds were imprisoned, and a few non-combatants were hanged. But there was no wholesale reign of terror comparable to that which later bloodied both France and Russia during their revolutions. For one thing, the colonists reflected Anglo-Saxon regard for order. For another, the leading Loyalists were prudent enough to flee to the British lines. About 80,000 loyal supporters of George III were driven out or fled, but several hundred thousand or so of the mild Loyalists were permitted to stay. The estates of many of the fugitives were confiscated and sold, a relatively painless way to help finance the war. Confiscation often worked great hardship as, for example, when two aristocratic women were forced to live in their former chicken house for leaning Toryward. Some 50,000 Loyalist volunteers at one time or another bore arms for the British. They also helped the king's cause by serving as spies, by inciting the Indians, and by keeping Patriot soldiers at home to protect their families. Ardent Loyalists had their hearts in their cause, and a major blunder of the haughty British was not to make full use of them in the fighting. With Boston evacuated in March 1776, the British concentrated on New York as a base of operations. Here was a splendid seaport, centrally located, where the king could count on cooperation from the numerous loyalists. An awe-inspiring British fleet appeared off New York in July 1776. It consisted of some 500 ships and 35,000 men, the largest armed force to be seen in America until the Civil War. George Washington, dangerously outnumbered, could muster only 18,000 ill-trained troops with which to meet the crack army of the invader. Disaster befell the Americans in the summer and fall of 1776. Outgeneraled and outmaneuvered, they were routed at the Battle of Long Island, where panic seized the raw recruits. By the narrowest of margins, and thanks to a favoring wind and fog, Washington escaped to Manhattan Island. Retreating northward, he crossed the Hudson River to New Jersey, and finally reached the Delaware River with the British close at his heels. Tauntingly, enemy buglers sounded the fox hunting call so familiar to Virginians of Washington's day. The Patriot cause was at low ebb when the rebel remnants fled across the river after collecting all available boats to forestall pursuit. The wonder is that Washington's adversary, General William Howe, did not speedily crush the demoralized American forces. But he was no military genius, and he well remembered the horrible slaughter at Bunker Hill, where he had commanded. The country was rough, supplies were slow in coming, and as a professional soldier, Howe did not relish the rigors of winter campaigning. He evidently found more agreeable the bedtime company of his mistress, the wife of one of his subordinates, a scandal with which American satirists had a good deal of ribald fun. Washington, who was now almost counted out, stealthily recrossed the ice-clogged Delaware River. At Trenton, on December 26, 1776, he surprised and captured 1,000 Hessians who were sleeping off the effects of their Christmas celebration. A week later, leaving his campfires burning as a ruse, he slipped away and inflicted a sharp defeat on a smaller British detachment at Princeton. This brilliant New Jersey campaign, crowned by these two life-saving victories, revealed old Fox Washington at his military best. In 1777, London officials adopted an intricate scheme for capturing the vital Hudson River Valley. If successful, the British would sever New England from the rest of the states and paralyze the American cause. The main invading force, under an actor-playwright-soldier, General John Gentleman Johnny Bergeon, would push down the Lake Champlain route from Canada. General Howe's troops in New York, if needed, could advance up the Hudson River to meet Bergeon near Albany. A third and much smaller British force, commanded by General Barry St. Leger, would come in from the west by way of Lake Ontario and the Mohawk Valley. British planners did not reckon with General Benedict Arnold. After his repulse at Quebec in 1775, he had retreated slowly along the St. Lawrence River back to the Lake Champlain area, by heroic efforts keeping an army in the field. The British had pursued his tattered force to Lake Champlain in 1776, but they could not move farther south until they had won control of the lake, which, in the absence of roads, was indispensable for carrying their supplies. While the British stopped to construct a sizable fleet, the tireless Arnold assembled and fitted out every floatable vessel. His tiny flotilla was finally destroyed after desperate fighting, but time, if not the battle, had been won. Winter was descending, and the British were forced to retire to Canada. General Bergeon had to start anew from this base the following year. If Arnold had not contributed his daring and skill, the British invaders of 1776 almost certainly would have recaptured Fort Ticonderoga. If Bergeon had started from this springboard in 1777, instead of from Montreal, he almost certainly would have succeeded in his venture. At last, the apparently futile American invasion of Canada in 1775 was beginning to pay rich dividends. General Bergeon began his fateful invasion with 7,000 regular troops. He was encumbered by a heavy baggage train and a considerable number of women, many of whom were wives of his officers. Progress was painfully slow, for sweaty axemen had to chop a path through the forest, while American militiamen began to gather like hornets on Bergeon's flanks. General Howe, meanwhile, was causing astonished eyebrows to rise. At a time when it seemed obvious that he should be starting up the Hudson River from New York to join his slowly advancing colleague, he deliberately embarked with the main British army for an attack on Philadelphia, the rebel capital. As scholars now know, he wanted to force a general engagement with Washington's army, destroy it, and leave the path wide open for Bergeon's thrust. Howe apparently assumed that he had ample time to assist Bergeon directly, should he be needed. General Washington, keeping a wary eye on the British in New York, hastily transferred his army to the vicinity of Philadelphia. There, late in 1777, he was defeated in two pitched battles at Brandywine Creek and Germantown. Pleasure-loving General Howe then settled down comfortably in the lively capital, leaving Bergeon to flounder through the wilds of Upper New York. Benjamin Franklin, recently sent to Paris as an envoy, truthfully jested that Howe had not captured Philadelphia, but that Philadelphia had captured Howe. Washington finally retired to winter quarters at Valley Forge, a strong hilly position some 20 miles northwest of Philadelphia. There, his frostbitten and hungry men were short of about everything except misery. This rabble was nevertheless whipped into a professional army by the recently arrived Prussian drillmaster, the profane but patient Baron von Steuben. Bergeon, meanwhile, had begun to bog down north of Albany, while a host of American militiamen, scenting the kill, swarmed about him. In a series of sharp engagements, in which General Arnold was again shot in the leg at Quebec, the British army was trapped. Meanwhile, the Americans had driven back St. Leger's force at Oriskany. Unable to advance or retreat, Bergeon was forced to surrender his entire command at Saratoga on October 17, 1777, to the American general Horatio Gates. Saratoga ranks high among the decisive battles of both American and world history. The victory immensely revived the faltering colonial cause. Even more important, it made possible the urgently needed foreign aid from France, which in turn helped ensure American independence. France, thirsting for revenge against Britain, was eager to inflame the quarrel that had broken out in America. Stripped of its North American colonies, Britain would presumably cease to be a front-rank power. France might then regain its former position and prestige, the loss of which, in the recent 7 Years' War, rankled deeply. For their part, the American revolutionaries badly needed help in the struggle to throw off the British yoke. The stage seemed set for the embattled new nation to make its diplomatic debut by sealing an alliance with France against the common British foe. Yet just as they stood for revolutionary political ideas at home, the rebellious Americans also harbored revolutionary ideas about international affairs. They wanted an end to colonialism and mercantilism. They strongly supported free trade and freedom of the seas. They hoped to substitute the rule of law for the ancient reliance on raw power to arbitrate the affairs of nations. When the new republic's great seal proclaimed a new order for the ages, Nouveau Ordre Seculorum in Latin, the sentiment was meant to apply to international as well as domestic affairs. The Continental Congress, in the summer of 1776, had accordingly drafted a model treaty to guide the American commissioners it was about to dispatch to the French court. One of the treaty's chief authors, John Adams, described its basic principles. Number one, no political connection. Number two, no military connection. Number three, only a commercial connection. For a nascent nation struggling to secure its very existence, these were remarkably self-denying restrictions. Yet they represented an emerging school of thought, popular among enlightened figures in both Europe and America, that deemed history to have reached a momentous turning point when military conflict would be abandoned and the bonds of mutual commercial interest would guarantee peaceful relations among states. Many critics, then and later, have derided this dream of an imminent golden age as hopelessly naive and impractically utopian. Yet it infused an element of idealism into American attitudes toward international affairs that has proved stubbornly persistent. When wily old Benjamin Franklin arrived in Paris to negotiate the treaty with France, he was determined that his very appearance should herald the diplomatic revolution the Americans hoped to achieve. In his clothing and demeanor, he affected a persona that deliberately violated every norm of diplomatic behavior. Instead of the customary ceremonial sword, he toted only a plain white walking stick. Forsaking ermine robes and fancy wigs, he sported homespun garments and a simple cap of marten fur. "Figure me," he wrote a friend, "very plainly dressed, wearing my thin gray straight hair that peeps out under my only coiffure, a fine fur cap which comes down my forehead almost to my spectacles. Think how this must appear among the powdered heads of Paris." He shocked the royal court, besotted as it was with pomp and protocol. But ordinary Parisians adored him as a specimen of a new democratic social order, devoid of pretense and ornament. When Franklin embraced and kissed the famed French philosopher Voltaire in a Paris theater, the spectators applauded wildly. Meanwhile, the diplomatic game intensified. After the humiliation at Saratoga in 1777, the British Parliament belatedly passed a measure that in effect offered the Americans home rule within the empire. This was essentially all that the colonials had ever asked for, except independence. If the French were going to break up the British Empire, they would have to bestir themselves. Franklin now played skillfully on French fears of Anglo-American reconciliation. On February 6, 1778, France offered the Americans a treaty of alliance. It did not conform exactly to the terms of the model treaty Franklin had brought with him, an early example of practical self-interest trumping abstract idealism in America's conduct of foreign affairs. Against its better judgment, the young republic concluded its first entangling military alliance and would soon regret it. But the treaty with France also constituted an official recognition of America's independence and lent powerful military heft to the patriot cause. Both allies bound themselves to wage war until the United States had fully secured its freedom and until both agreed to terms with the common enemy. With those pledges, the American Revolutionary War now became a world war. England and France thus came to blows in 1778, and the shot fired at Lexington rapidly widened into a global conflagration. Spain entered the fray against Britain in 1779, as did Holland. Combined Spanish and French fleets outnumbered those of Britain, and on two occasions the British Isles seemed to be at the mercy of hostile warships. The weak maritime neutrals of Europe, who had suffered from Britain's dominance over the seas, now began to demand more respect for their rights. In 1780, the imperious Catherine the Great of Russia took the lead in organizing the Armed Neutrality, a lineup of almost all the remaining European neutrals in an attitude of passive hostility toward Britain. She later sneeringly called this the Armed Nullity. The war was now being fought not only in Europe and North America, but also in South America, the Caribbean, and Asia. To say that America, with some French aid, defeated Britain is like saying, "Daddy and I killed the bear." To Britain, struggling for its very life, the scuffle in the New World became secondary. The Americans deserve credit for having kept the war going until 1778, with secret French aid. But they did not achieve their independence until the conflict erupted into a multi-power world war that was too big for Britain to handle. From 1778 to 1783, France provided the rebels with guns, money, immense amounts of equipment, about one-half of America's regular armed forces, and practically all of the new nation's naval strength. France's entrance into the conflict forced the British to change their basic strategy in America. Hitherto, they could count on blockading the colonial coast and commanding the seas. Now the French had powerful fleets in American waters, chiefly to protect their own valuable West Indies islands, but in a position to jeopardize Britain's blockade and lines of supply. The British, therefore, decided to evacuate Philadelphia and concentrate their strength in New York City. In June 1778, the withdrawing Redcoats were attacked by General Washington at Monmouth, New Jersey, on a blisteringly hot day. Scores of men collapsed or died from sunstroke, but the battle was indecisive and the British escaped to New York, although about one-third of their Hessians deserted. Henceforth, except for the Yorktown interlude of 1781, Washington remained in the New York area hemming in the British. In the summer of 1780, a powerful French army of 6,000 regular troops, commanded by the Comte de Rochambeau, arrived in Newport, Rhode Island. The Americans were somewhat suspicious of their former enemies. In fact, several ugly flare-ups involving minor bloodshed had already occurred between the new allies. But French gold and goodwill melted hard hearts. Dancing parties were arranged with the prim Puritan maidens. One French officer related, doubtless with exaggeration, the simple innocence of the Garden of Eden prevailed. No real military advantage came immediately from this French reinforcement, although preparations were made for a Franco-American attack on New York. Improving American morale was staggered later in 1780 when General Benedict Arnold turned traitor. A leader of undoubted dash and brilliance, he was ambitious, greedy, unscrupulous, and suffering from a well-grounded but petulant feeling that his valuable services were not fully appreciated. He plotted with the British to sell out the key stronghold of West Point, which commanded the Hudson River, for £6,300 and an officer's commission. By the sheerest accident, the plot was detected in the nick of time, and Arnold fled to the British. "Whom can we trust now?" cried George Washington in anguish. The British, meanwhile, had devised a plan to roll up the colonies, beginning with the South, where the Loyalists were numerous. The colony of Georgia was ruthlessly overrun in 1778 to 1779. Charleston, South Carolina, fell in 1780. The surrender of the city to the British involved the capture of 5,000 men and 400 cannon, and was a heavier loss to the Americans, in relation to existing strength, than that of Bourguignon was to the British. Warfare now intensified in the Carolinas, where patriots bitterly fought their loyalist neighbors. It was not uncommon for prisoners on both sides to be butchered in cold blood after they had thrown down their arms. The tide turned later in 1780 and early in 1781 when American riflemen wiped out a British detachment at King's Mountain and then defeated a smaller force at Cowpens. In the Carolina campaign of 1781, General Nathaniel Greene, a Quaker rear tactician, distinguished himself by his strategy of delay. Standing and then retreating, he exhausted his foe, General Charles Cornwallis, in vain pursuit. By losing battles but winning campaigns, the fighting Quaker finally succeeded in clearing most of Georgia and South Carolina of British troops. The West was ablaze during much of the war. Indian allies of George III, hoping to protect their land, were busy with torch and tomahawk. They were egged on by British agents branded as hair buyers because they paid bounties for American scalps. Fateful 1777 was known as the Bloody Year on the frontier. Although two nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, the Oneidas and the Tuscaroras, sided with the Americans, the Senecas, Mohawks, Cayugas, and Onondagas joined the British. They were urged on by Mohawk chief Joseph Brant, a convert to Anglicanism, who believed, not without reason, that a victorious Britain would restrain American expansion into the West. Brant and the British ravaged large areas of backcountry Pennsylvania and New York until checked by an American force in 1779. In 1784, the pro-British Iroquois were forced to sign the Treaty of Fort Stanwix, the first treaty between the United States and an Indian nation. Under its terms, the Indians ceded most of their land. Yet even in wartime, the human tide of westward-moving pioneers did not halt its flow. Eloquent testimony is provided by place names in Kentucky, such as Lexington, named after the battle, and Louisville, named after America's new ally, Louis XVI. In the wild Illinois country, the British were especially vulnerable to attack, for they held only scattered posts that they had captured from the French. An audacious frontiersman, George Rogers Clark, conceived the idea of seizing these forts by surprise. In 1778 to 1779, he floated down the Ohio River with about 175 men and captured in quick succession the forts Kaskaskia, Cahokia, and Vincennes. Clark's admirers have argued, without positive proof, that his success forced the British to cede the region north of the Ohio River to the United States at the peace table in Paris. America's infant navy had meanwhile been laying the foundations of a brilliant tradition. The naval establishment consisted of only a handful of nondescript ships commanded by daring officers, the most famous of whom was a hard-fighting young Scotsman, John Paul Jones. As events turned out, this tiny naval force never made a real dent in Britain's thunderous fleets. Its chief contribution was in destroying British merchant shipping and thus carrying the war into the waters around the British Isles. More numerous and damaging than ships of the regular American Navy were swift privateers. These craft were privately owned armed ships, legalized pirates in a sense, specifically authorized by Congress to prey on enemy shipping. Altogether, over 1,000 American privateers, responding to the call of patriotism and profit, sallied forth with about 70,000 men, sailors of fortune. They captured some 600 British prizes, while British warships captured about as many American merchantmen and privateers. Privateering was not an unalloyed asset. It had the unfortunate effect of diverting manpower from the main war effort and involving Americans, including Benedict Arnold, in speculation and graft. But the privateers brought in urgently needed gold, harassed the enemy, and raised American morale by providing victories at a time when victories were few. British shipping was so badly riddled by privateers and by the regular American Navy that insurance rates skyrocketed. Merchant ships were compelled to sail in convoy, and British shippers and manufacturers brought increasing pressure on Parliament to end the war on honorable terms. One of the darkest periods of the war was 1780 to 1781, before the last decisive victory. Inflation of the currency continued at full gallop. The government, virtually bankrupt, declared that it would repay many of its debts at the rate of only 2.5 cents on the dollar. Despair prevailed, the sense of unity withered, and mutinous sentiments infected the army. Meanwhile, the British General Cornwallis was blundering into a trap. After futile operations in Virginia, he had fallen back to Chesapeake Bay at Yorktown to await seaborne supplies and reinforcements. He assumed Britain would continue to control the sea. But these few fateful weeks happened to be one of the brief periods during the war when British naval superiority slipped away. The French were now prepared to cooperate energetically in a brilliant stroke. Admiral de Grasse, operating with a powerful fleet in the West Indies, advised the Americans that he was free to join with them in an assault on Cornwallis at Yorktown. Quick to seize this opportunity, General Washington made a swift march of more than 300 miles to the Chesapeake from the New York area. Accompanied by Rochambeau's French army, Washington beset the British by land, while de Grasse blockaded them by sea after beating off the British fleet. Completely cornered, Cornwallis surrendered his entire force of 7,000 men on October 19, 1781. As his band appropriately played, the world turned upside down. The triumph was no less French than American. The French provided essentially all the sea power and about half of the regular troops in the besieging army of some 16,000 men. Stunned by news of the disaster, Prime Minister Lord North cried, "Oh God, it's all over, it's all over." But it was not. George III stubbornly planned to continue the struggle, for Britain was far from being crushed. It still had 54,000 troops in North America, including 32,000 in the United States. Washington returned with his army to New York, there to continue keeping a vigilant eye on the British force of 10,000 men. Fighting actually continued for more than a year after Yorktown, with patriot, loyalist warfare in the South especially savage. No quarter for Tories was the common battle cry. One of Washington's most valuable contributions was to keep the languishing cause alive, the army in the field, and the states together during these critical months. Otherwise, a satisfactory peace treaty might never have been signed. After Yorktown, despite George III's obstinate eagerness to continue fighting, many Britons were weary of war and increasingly ready to come to terms. They had suffered heavy reverses in India and in the West Indies. The island of Menorca in the Mediterranean had fallen. The Rock of Gibraltar was tottering. Lord North's ministry collapsed in March 1782, temporarily ending the personal rule of George III. A Whig ministry, rather favorable to the Americans, replaced the Tory regime of Lord North. Three American peace negotiators had meanwhile gathered at Paris. The aging but astute Benjamin Franklin, the flinty John Adams, vigilant for New England interests, and the impulsive John Jay of New York, deeply suspicious of old world intrigue. The three envoys had explicit instructions from Congress to make no separate peace and to consult with their French allies at all stages of the negotiations. But the American representatives chafed under this directive. They well knew that it had been written by a subservient Congress, with the French Foreign Office indirectly guiding the pen. France was in a painful position. It had induced Spain to enter the war on its side, in part by promising to deliver British-held Gibraltar. Yet the towering rock was defying frantic joint assaults by French and Spanish troops. Spain also coveted the immense trans-Allegheny area on which restless American pioneers were already settling. France, ever eager to smash Britain's empire, desired an independent United States, but one independent in the abstract, not in action. It therefore schemed to keep the new republic cooped up east of the Allegheny Mountains. A weak America, like a horse sturdy enough to plow, but not vigorous enough to kick, would be easier to manage in promoting French interests and policy. France was paying a heavy price in men and treasure to win America's independence, and it wanted to get its money's worth. But John Jay was unwilling to play France's game. Suspiciously alert, he perceived that the French could not satisfy the conflicting ambitions of both Americans and Spaniards. He saw signs, or thought he did, indicating that the Paris Foreign Office was about to betray America's trans-Appalachian interest to satisfy those of Spain. He therefore secretly made separate overtures to London, contrary to his instructions from Congress. The hard-pressed British, eager to entice one of their enemies from the alliance, speedily came to terms with the Americans.